Life is weird. People are weirder.
And we're just trying to make it through without ending up in straitjackets. Because how would we drink our wine?
I'm Pascal LaForest.
And I'm Solène Castrovilla. We're cousins, besties, and the voices behind Life in Jest, a podcast that tackles the strange, the dark, and the ridiculous.
With a healthy dose of sarcasm and whatever humor we can wring from the madness.
From true crime to pop culture to stories too bizarre to be fiction,
we're unpacking it all, one sip of wine at a time.
Follow Life in Jest wherever you get your podcasts.
Because honestly, we don't know what's coming out of our mouths next either. Bum 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 bum. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Go Help Yourself, a comedy self-help podcast to make life suck less. I am your host for this episode. My name is Misty Stinnett. And if this is your first time tuning in, this is the podcast where we read and review popular self-help books, and we give you the summary and the main points in about 45 minutes or less so that you can know if they're worth your time or a total trash fire to avoid. We also cover anything and everything under the sun involved in self-help. So we cover thought-provoking questions, we have trivia, we explore articles, new concepts, and every now and then we are lucky enough to have a guest author on. And I am so excited for the episode that we're bringing you today because it's on a topic that I have been personally interested in for a very, very long time. And today I am so excited to welcome to the podcast author Carla Lito.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So before we dive in, I just want to tell our audience a little bit about you and your work, Carla. So Carla Lito, M-A-L-M-F-T, is a licensed marriage and family therapist with two master's degrees in psychology and a successful private practice in Los Angeles, California, who helps many people improve their personal relationships and transform their lives. Using her detective skills and keen manipulation radar, she is known as the tell-it-like-it-is therapist who cuts right through the bullshit to help her stuck clients get unstuck. Carla is happily married with more cats than kids. In her downtime, she enjoys practicing Brazilian jiu-jitsu, watching stand-up comedy, and eating pizza. I love that bio. And can you tell me for a moment, why Brazilian jiu-jitsu?
Oh my God, I love it. I've always loved martial arts. You know what? It's just a great way to learn self-defense, practice self-defense, have fun. It's like, I mean, other nicknames for it are murder yoga. it's like, I feel like I'm doing gymnastics with a partner, but we're like kind of getting violent while we're doing gymnastics. I don't know.
It's so fun.
It's one of those things you either love it or you want nothing to do with it.
So you're making me want to try it, actually, because it sounds like graceful and strategic and also feral.
It is all those things. Yes.
I love it. Well, We are going to, I think, talk quite a bit today about protective energy and protecting oneself. And so I'm just going to dive right in. So, Carla, you are a licensed marriage and family therapist, and also the author of the book, Outsmarting Egomaniacs, How to Respond to Narcissists and Master Manipulators. So can you tell us a bit about why you wrote this book?
Yeah. So I've been helping a lot of my clients with this exact topic. When, you know, they would come to me, you know, while they're in a toxic relationship or an abusive relationship, or at the tail end of one or right after leaving one. But also, like, I grew up around toxic, narcissistic personalities from a very young age. So I've been very familiar with it, and then was really fascinated in, you know, learning about the personality disorders in graduate school. And so when I became a therapist and I was helping clients, I felt like I really quickly grasped what it is and how to deal with it. And I had my own journey of learning how to deal with it and protect myself. And so writing the book is about helping, like, giving people the knowledge that I learned along the way and wanting people to, you know, find out as soon as they can on their journey. I basically wrote the book that would have helped me or saved me a long time ago. Mm. The book I wish I could have read when I was younger. Mm. So I just like put it all out there for everyone, you know.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Because with my limited understanding, this is a really intense topic for those who are experiencing it. Mm-hmm. And it can have like pretty long lasting impacts. So I'm just going to tell everyone just very quickly a little about your book. So your book is divided into four parts. Mm-hmm. We've got part one, Egomaniacs Come with a Bag of Tricks. Part two, Know Your Enemy, which is where you outline the different types of egomaniacs and the manipulation tactics each type tends to use, which I thought was so insightful and incredibly eye-opening. I didn't know that before. Part three, Becoming Bulletproof, which is all about knowing yourself, kind of reflecting on how you got here, setting clear boundaries and detaching, right, from the person or relationships that you're struggling with. And then part four, Your New Life, which covers building your confidence, making the right connections, and what you call an asshole-free zone. Yeah, so we'll cover a little bit on each part of the book. And I just want to say for those listening, I said this to you before we started recording, but your style of writing really reminded me of Mark Manson's The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. You are not afraid of a swear word. You are not afraid of being like, essentially, listen, bitch, this is what's happening. Yes. Yeah, so I really appreciated that, like, straightforward, it like it is.
I love that you said that because Mark Manson was definitely one of the authors that inspired me and that I wanted to emulate in terms of, like, my voice and my style. Mm. When you see other authors doing it and it works well, it's like it told me, I can do that. I can have my unfiltered voice on the page talking about serious stuff, but doing it in my own way. So,
yeah. And it feels more like a friend and less formal, which I always appreciate because when it's some kind of intimate thing that I'm struggling with or someone I love is struggling with, it's like you kind of want someone to pull you aside and be like, let me give it to you straight. You know, this is what's happening. Don't, you know, you don't want someone who's like, so listen, here's how it is. So I really appreciated that. And to jump right in, you know, even in the title, you mention egomaniacs, narcissists, and master manipulators. Mm-hmm. So what are the differences between those kind of broad three categories? And how can someone listening go about identifying what types of manipulators might be in their lives?
Yeah. So in chapter one, I really talk about the spectrum of narcissism. I think egomaniacs are really on the spectrum kind of before narcissists and narcissistic personality disorder. Mm. You know, narcissists are egomaniacs for sure, but not all egomaniacs are narcissists.
Mm.
And so, I mean, I guess you could kind of say an egomaniac is a narcissist light or whatever. Like, you know,
diet narcissist. Yeah.
Yeah. Like they have the traits and the characteristics, but maybe they're capable of self-reflecting and seeing it and wanting to improve. Maybe they're emotionally immature. In a man, sometimes it's toxic masculinity that they like can or can't undo at a certain point in their life. So, you know, one of the defining characteristics of a narcissist is that they never change. And I think egomaniacs can, to a degree. You know, some people know that they are a bit of an egomaniac and want to work on it for their relationship or as they emotionally mature and they can improve. But a narcissist can't even get to that point. So I think narcissist is just deeper and more ingrained and more serious and more dangerous than an egomaniac.
Mm. And you mentioned the word disorder. Mm-hmm. So egomaniac may be sort of a...
I don't see it as a disorder. It's a personality trait.
Mm.
And narcissistic personality disorder is a set of personality traits. And they're at such a high level that it causes dysfunction. I think an egomaniac can probably have relationships and, you know, a career, you know, they're okay. And, you know, maybe they're intolerable in high doses if they're not working on it. But they don't have a disorder. It's just like they have this personality. the personality disorder, the narcissist, someone who has a narcissistic personality disorder, they have the traits of an egomaniac, and it's deep and it's ingrained, and they're never going to change. It's never going to get better. It's only going to get worse with time.
Oh my
and it's
God.
Also dangerous because, like you said, master manipulator. How does that fit in?
Yeah. How does that fit in?
Well, you know, a high level narcissist is a master manipulator. So they're very manipulative. An egomaniac is manipulative too. I think when we talk about a master manipulator, someone very manipulative. And so it's kind of like me saying, let's not worry about if it's an egomaniac or a narcissist. If you're getting manipulated,
yeah,
here's what to do. You know what
Which
I mean?
Is so helpful because I think, you know, and I'm, Lord knows I am so guilty of this, but in today's self-help, internet-driven, Instagram therapist kind of world, I feel like we all have so much more knowledge than we ever had. Mm-hmm. And we all have so much more therapeutic speak on our fingertips or the tips of our tongues. And thinking about like trying to diagnose what something is versus just like, you know what, this doesn't feel good. You know what, this person makes me not trust myself. Or, you know, going back to just like you don't even have to get to the cause. You can just look at the symptoms, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's super helpful. So mm-hmm. I'm jumping ahead in my outline here, but because you have already said it, so narcissists can never be cured. There's no cure.
No, I mean, the chief trait of narcissism is an inability to, there's a total lack of self-awareness. And so they can't self-reflect. That's why they don't have empathy for other people's because they're not thinking about their mistakes or their character defects or their bad behavior ever.
Do they know they're narcissists?
No. So, no. They're very good at seeing narcissism in other narcissists. They can identify what narcissism is, but they don't see it in themselves.
Oh my God.
Yeah. No, they think they're great. They think they're amazing. Like,
oh no. Oh yeah. No. Is anyone else listening being like, am I a narcissist?
That's so funny. You're like, really, like, just like in the book, it's like everybody who's ever been victimized by a narcissist wonders, wait a minute, what, am I the narcissist or am I the crazy person? Because they do such a miraculous job of projection and gaslighting and having you think that like maybe the problem really is you because that's what they want you to believe.
Yeah.
Because they're trying to protect their fragile ego and they don't want to touch their shame. I mean, that's what narcissism is. It's not, they don't think that they're so amazing and wonderful like they want you to believe.
Yeah.
They actually feel so much shame about themselves and they mask it with all that arrogance and right. superiority complex so that the moment you accuse them of something or you call them out on their bad behavior, all mm-hmm. they're interested in doing is turning it around on you so they don't ever have to look at themselves.
Okay, so this is terrifying. Basically, what you're saying is it never gets better.
No.
They have no idea. They think they're amazing.
Yeah.
So it's just, whew.
Yeah.
Ella, man. Okay, getting into the meat of it already. So the term narcissism is, I'm sure you get asked this all the time, but it is thrown around so much these days. Like, I feel like so many, if someone is confident or just into themselves, or maybe like you were just describing that egomaniac category,
mm-hmm.
people are so quick to write someone off as a narcissist. Mm-hmm. So can you help our listeners understand, like, what, in addition to what you've already described, what are some of the key traits of mm-hmm. narcissism beyond just this popular conception?
Yeah. And, you know, narcissism isn't confidence at all. It's arrogance.
Mm.
Confidence is healthy narcissism. It's not, you know, the toxic kind that's like a personality disorder. When you're confident, you don't mind constructive criticism and you don't compare yourself to others, which is all narcissists do, is compare themselves to other people and they can't handle any kind of criticism. So, I mean, there's that. There's the arrogance. And so with arrogance is belittling other people, putting them down, talking, you know, speaking negatively about other people, spreading rumors. There's the grandiosity element of, you know, fluffing themselves up and making themselves important.
Mm-hmm.
They lie about stuff, their accomplishments, you know, whatever it takes to feel like the most important person in the room. Mm-hmm. They're exploitive and manipulative. It's just all about getting what they need. So a lot of times, this is like the lack of self-reflection piece. It's like, they'll do something really egregious, but they have a whole justification for like why it's okay that they did it. You know,
and they
believe it. Yeah. So it's not like they don't know that they stole or they don't know that they, lost their temper or whatever. Well, I was like, well, but you pushed me, you know, like, to do that. Or, well, that's why I yelled. Or, oh, I didn't steal. I deserved it. And it's mine, actually, because of X, Y, Z. Like, they really believe all their own bullshit. And so that's why they're not seeing themselves as they are. They're trying to convince themselves that they're this amazing, flawless, special, brilliant, you know, flawless person. And anyone who challenges them has the problem.
When you say that, I almost picture like a cartoon character in my head, right? Like arrogance, this egregiousness. It seems like it would be really obvious, like almost a caricature of a person. And so you would think like it's easy to spot the narcissist in the room, right?
Right.
So, but that's not always the case, right? So like, what are some of the ways that a narcissist, like, are there narcissists who are just deeply beloved, you know, by their family, their friends, their community? Like, what are the different ways that I almost want to say, like, what are the different disguises they can wear? But really, like, what are the different skins that they can be in?
Yeah, because a lot of them can be very charming and seductive in that way. And, you know, they don't always just start, you know, trash talking people, right? You know, that comes out when they get pushed, you know, like they play the victim, you know. Right. But, you know, when you first meet them, it's like they like to be the hero. They like the grandiosity. So it can be very seductive at first when they're.
Or even subtle.
Yeah.
Like, look at their altruism.
Right.
They volunteer with a whole bunch of, like, things like that.
Right. And it's like kind of one of the examples. Sometimes I would reference, you know, documentaries and TV series in the book. And one of them is the character in The Undoing on HBO of Hugh Grant, who was this, like, altruistic, you know, doctor of, you know, saving children from cancer or whatever, you know. And he was a murderer. Sorry for the disclaimer. Wait, disclaimer alert.
Spoiler. I haven't seen it.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, but it's, you know, yeah, I mean, they can hide behind all kinds of masks, the, you know, altruist mask or the charming mask or whatever they want you to believe or whoever they, whatever kind of character they like to play. But one thing's for sure, they're always either the hero or the victim because they're not going to be the villain.
Right.
You know,
right. And either way,
right,
they're innocent.
Right.
Or golden.
I mean, someone who really needs to be the hero all the time, who needs to be special, that's your kind of your giveaway, you know? When you pick up on that need to be the hero in every story or make you believe how important or powerful or brilliant they are.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's like why are you trying to convince us right away?
Even if it's done in a subtle way, right? Just subtly making a case for their brilliance. Or see, that's what really trips me up because I think when I first, you know, heard about narcissism, I was like, oh, yeah, that sounds super easy to spot, you know? And then looking back on some of my own experiences, I've thought, oh, my gosh, that was a narcissistic, like, I think a clinically narcissistic person, and you'd never guess it.
Yeah, usually it seeps out when you get closer because if they're really skilled, I mean, look, even if they're very manipulative, they're not going to just let you know they're a predator at first glance. They know.
Well, and they
how
don't know they're
you.
A predator, right? Or they think
yeah,
it, like,
true.
Like you said. So, like, okay, and I have, gosh, I have so many questions I want to ask you, but, like, so say they are behaving in a narcissistic way, they're getting closer to you, and we'll talk about maybe some of the stages that someone might go through in a relationship with a narcissist later on, but are they aware that they are manipulating you, or is this just like a pattern that they fall into that they don't even recognize as a pattern?
Right. They don't recognize it. They're just trying to get their needs met, and their needs are like an endless well. You'll never satisfy them because it's always about them. And it's they always think they're right. They always think that they're deserving. They don't really think about or care about another person's experience, you know?
Oof. Okay, so next question. Why is narcissism considered so dangerous?
Well, it's the exploitation and the manipulation, and it can be really damaging to your sense of self. So if you get close to a narcissist, whether you're, you know, dating one or you're growing up with one in the family, they plant self-doubt seeds and really make you, you know, you get used to kind of orbiting around them to make sure that they don't get upset, because there's a big price to pay when you ruffle the feathers of a narcissist, right? Like you don't, so you get kind of used to neglecting yourself to accommodate someone that you don't want to go off the rails, or you don't want to be mad at you because of what happens when this person gets mad at you, you know?
And what kind of like, what spectrum of going off the rails could look like?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of different types of narcissists. You know, you have ones who are, who have anger and who, you know, might just get very explosive anger and, you know, become, you know, abusive. Others are more like silent and cunning, where it's like they silently punish you. And, you know, so there are different
ways. More psychological warfare. Some are physical.
Right. Different ways of getting punished for not meeting all of the narcissist's demands. Yeah.
How many people do you estimate are affected by narcissistic relationships?
Well, you know, I saw a statistic once that said 60 million people. And then that made me think for a second, like, I mean, that's a lot. And when you think about it, I mean, I think the number's infinite, because when you think about it, one narcissist doesn't just affect one other person, right? They come into contact with so many people and affect them in so many different ways. Think about how one person affects people at work, and then affects everyone in their family, and then affects everybody they date. And then
for their whole life.
Yeah. And it's like, and it's a ripple. I mean, it's just one narcissist is probably affecting, you know, thousands of people at once. You know,
oh my God,
in one lifetime, maybe more.
I'm wondering, in your practice or in your research, have you seen that more men tend to be narcissists or more women tend to be narcissists, or it's just kind of a luck of the draw?
You know, when I have people come see me because they are in a relationship with a narcissist or breaking up with one, I see just as many men suffering from a female narcissist as I see women suffering from a male narcissist. I think there, you know, there might be a statistic that it's more men than women. I don't know if that's true.
Sure.
And they're just as vile, you know?
Like, right. This is affecting everyone at all levels.
You know,
or can.
Yeah.
Can. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. And what does the current research tell us about how narcissism develops? Like, how does a perfectly innocent baby be born and then grow up to be this, like, cunning master manipulator?
Yeah. You know, it's both nurture and nature, right? So you're born with a set of personality traits. And so if your personality traits are already predisposed to narcissistic traits, right, and then your environment will shape your personality in one direction or another. So if you're already kind of a bratty kid, let's say, and your parents totally give in to the demands of that bratty kid, what they're doing is positively reinforcing the self-entitled behavior. And so that's how you grow an egocentric, self-entitled person who risks becoming a narcissist as they grow up. You know, you're teaching them omnipotent control. If I just keep demanding, if I cry harder and louder, eventually mom and dad give in. And if I can control my parents, I can control anyone.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
Enabling, spoiling parenting can definitely have an effect.
And you also write about like a definitive moment of shame, right? Mm-hmm. As kind of the other way.
The narcissistic wound. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, they also talk about in research that, I mean, because it does make sense to, like, you know, bullies bully. So also children who've been abused and neglected, risk growing up to become narcissists too. And that tells me that there was probably a narcissistic parent. Narcissism is genetically inherited. So
genetically.
Yeah. I mean, it's a personality trait, right? So you're getting, right? So you can inherit the narcissistic personality traits. And again, it's really about what happens in that environment when you have narcissistic personality traits. What happens? Is it being positively reinforced through spoiling? Or maybe in another direction, another setting is you're neglected and abused and filled with shame, and you never learn how to self-regulate or self-soothe.
Right. The wound is too deep. You just can't touch it anymore.
Right. And when you're bullied, you know, you learn bullying. And so that behavior is modeled for you. So now behavior is modeled for you, and you already have the personality to kind of be that way. And so, I mean, it's a different way that someone can become a narcissist.
Yeah.
But like the narcissistic wound that, you know, you're talking about, that shame, it's like for a narcissist, they experience shame and they never learn how to properly cope with that shame or self-soothe. They don't have caretakers who teach them to self-regulate. And so the shame just becomes too unbearable. And then they're spending the rest of their life kind of trying to manage that shame or deflect from that shame. They can't touch that shame. That's why they have no self-awareness. That's why they're turning everything back around on the other person.
Mm-hmm.
So they've never learned how to process their own shame. People who aren't narcissists can process shame. It's like, oh, you know, you feel bad and you say you're sorry and, you know.
Yeah, and you feel mm-hmm. that, you know, those feelings in your body mm-hmm. and find a way to move it through or mm-hmm. metabolize it somehow.
Yeah, you can actually talk about your misdeed, right? Your mistake and say, yeah. Like, oh my God, I feel really bad. I'm so sorry. I shouldn't have done that. A narcissist never admits I shouldn't have done that because that shame button is too triggering. They can't go there.
Interesting. Would they ever say I shouldn't have done that if it's in a manipulative way to try and get you to?
I mean, yeah, they'll do. They'll do whatever it takes to manipulate you. Usually, if they're admitting I shouldn't have done that, it's probably couched in some kind of like image saving frame of like, I shouldn't have done that, but you, or well, I shouldn't have done that, but you know, there's always going to be, you know, there's never a pure apology or a pure self accountability. It's always like, I'm still right. I'm still not bad.
Yeah.
While I'm saying sorry, kind of,
yeah.
Right? Like it's never just a pure like, wow, like I shouldn't have done that. I'm so sorry. Like I wasn't thinking, you know, it's never just full on. I screwed up. It's always some sort of justification of what you did wrong or how they were provoked or something like that, you know?
And as far as early warning signs, because I think the topic of dating comes up a lot with narcissism, right?
Yeah.
And like you said at the beginning of this recording, you want to help people identify early, right?
Yeah.
If the person across from them is a narcissist. So for people who are dating, what are the early warning signs that they might be involved with a narcissist?
Yeah. And I mean, these are warning signs because like you can't really tell if someone's for sure a narcissist right away. But, you know, some things that indicate that someone is egocentric and might be a narcissist is when they talk exclusively about themselves. And kind of like we were talking about earlier where they're like auditioning and trying to prove how special and amazing they are rather than find out anything about you. So when you experience a person just kind of spending the time just letting you know how great they are and rattling off all their accomplishments or convincing you of how amazing they are, that's egocentric. That could be someone on, you know, down that spectrum. You know, something narcissists and egomaniacs do a lot is they compete, like they'll top your story where they always have to kind of bring it back to them. So when you're like, oh, you know, you mentioned an accomplishment or something you're proud of, they always have a story about how they did it better or would have done it better or have a story to top that one of how they're even better. Yeah.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. It's funny because in my family, the way that I was kind of originally brought up to communicate is if somebody said like, oh, yeah, I used to do theater, you know, like the way that we would relate would mm-hmm. be like, oh, I did theater, too. You know, like what plays did you do? And it like is.
Yeah, that's not the same. That's like, oh, we have something in common. The narcissistic version of that is like, you know, you're like, I did theater and I by senior year, I was the lead. I got the lead role of, you know, Mamma Mia or whatever.
Yeah.
And the narcissist is like, well, I got the lead role in Mamma Mia when I was a freshman. So
barf. If someone did that to me on a date, I am just like, check, please.
Right. Like, it's just kind of like, I did it better. Like, I'm better. Yeah. I got there first. I'm more amazing. Like, there's always some kind of, it's not Me Too moments of like, you know, same here. Like, that's bonding.
It feels like one-upsmanship.
It's one-upsmanship. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So those are like some first date or like first few dates kind of early warning signs. What about love bombing?
Yeah, I feel like love people bombing always.
Because love bombing, oh my gosh, when you're being love bombed, it feels so good, right? Yeah. Doesn't feel manipulative, right? Yeah. If you're being, because for those, you know, who are maybe new to this topic, like there are things, right, that the narcissist can do, like mirroring your personality or like pretending they're interested in your hobbies or, you know, all types of things to kind of make you on the receiving end feel like, is this my soulmate? Like, have I found like the perfect person for me? So
I mean, love bombing, you know, that idea that they're just, you know, goo goo gaga over you the first second they meet you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, my opinion on love bombing is if you're getting love bombed, pay attention. It doesn't mean necessarily that they're a narcissist. Narcissists do use love bombing, but so many other things look like love bombing, and so many different types of people might love bomb who aren't narcissists
mm-hmm.
because, you know, what you're talking about is someone who's not genuine, and it takes a minute to find out that they're, you know, really not interested in your hobbies, that they were just bullshitting you, right?
Yeah.
Or that they're really not the person they were pretending to be, that they were just, you know, right. So sometimes people come on really strong for a variety of reasons. Like they, you know, feel things right away and they have a poor filter. You know, people with ADHD blurt things out and they're like, oh my God, why did I talk about marriage and kids on the second date? Like, you know what I mean? They're not narcissists. They're just, you know, so I don't think that if you're getting love bomb, it's pay attention to other things, but I don't think it's necessarily a narcissist because you feel that this is too much too soon. There's a lot of reasons why it could be too much too soon. And it takes a while to find out that someone isn't really who they say they are. That's, you know, usually several weeks, several days, several months.
Right. And where you're like, several months. You're already fully attached by that time, though, you know, deeply in love.
I mean, I have a client who got in a relationship with a guy who pretended to be in medical school because he knew that she really wanted to marry or like be with a doctor. Like she had like a thing about like her dream was to be with a doctor.
Wait, but that's so unsustainable.
Oh, yeah.
She was gonna find out he wasn't.
Oh, and when she did, she was like, okay, you're a liar and like a con man, get out. But like it took some time, you know, where he was like, oh, I was gonna be a doctor, but then I changed careers to this. And she's like, well, you were a med student, so that means you understand, you know, the body and health. And that was something that was like really appealing to her. And maybe you'll pick it back up another, you know, maybe you do want to still be a doctor. So she was like in this fantasy of like, maybe I found my doctor. And he was like just a complete, I mean, yeah, he was, you know, he was a fraud. But so what I'm saying is it takes a minute. I think he was like moving in too when by the time she figured it out.
Oh my God. Mm-hmm, that's mm-hmm. so scary. I mean, like I naively just wish that I didn't know that these types of people were in the world. You know, it's like so scary.
I know.
To think that people are just walking around out there who just can fully lie about something that big.
Well, there's a whole chapter on pathological liars and con artists in my book. So
yes.
There are people like that, and you can read a whole chapter about them if that blows your mind. Because, I mean, yeah, it's mind-blowing.
It's mind-blowing. And I think there's a lot of smart people, smart, kind, talented, successful people who are duped by narcissists and master manipulators.
Oh,
so
yeah.
is it just that they are that good, that skilled?
Yeah, because, I mean, if you've ever been conned or duped by a narcissist, it doesn't mean that you aren't smart enough to catch it. They really know how to operate your trigger buttons and kind of get under your skin, and whatever they learn about you, they use. They're very persuasive, very convincing. They can convince you of anything, you know?
Yeah. And charming, potentially beloved, potentially the hero.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you're already looking at them with rose-colored glasses, or like, look at this amazing person who is interested in the things I'm interested in and aligned with the things I've been looking for.
And often they have like some nice traits or nice behaviors where it's confusing. You know, I've heard so many clients say to me like, well, they were so nice to me in the beginning, or, well, but they did these nice things for me too. And it's like, well, hold on. They're not like monsters, like out of a cartoon. Like, they're still people. And if they were 100% evil every moment of their existence, you wouldn't have had a second date with them.
Right.
They have to have some good qualities. They have to behave well and be nice sometimes, or you wouldn't even be in anywhere near them in the first place.
Mm.
So it's really like when you get to know them, you know, as soon as someone starts to invalidate your experience, when you feel that you're invisible and you have no voice in the relationship, when it feels like you're walking on eggshells or, you know, tiptoeing through a minefield, that's when you want to pause and think about what kind of relationship it is and who this person actually is.
Right, which can be so challenging if the first few months or even first few years were set this belief system of this incredible person.
Right.
Right. Or that love bombing that felt so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Thinking, no, that's who they really are. Not this behavior. They're just having an off moment.
I mean, another thing to think about is how they're the common denominator in their life. Like, so when you hear, when you're dating someone and you hear that all of their exes are crazy.
Yeah.
That's a huge red flag, because all of them really, like, so you're not the common denominator in all these bad relationships.
Yeah.
When people in their family won't talk to them, not just one person, but like if it's several people in their family of like cut them off, you know, I mean, maybe their whole family is toxic, but if, you know, I would start to think about it. Like, why is, you know, when there are multiple parties and situations where this person has all of these burned bridges, you know, and when they talk about everyone as somehow screwed up because they're no longer a part of their life.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. You write about this in the chapter. I think you call it like the importance of like third party validation or like third party opinion on folks. But sometimes you don't even meet anyone in their life until
that's a red flag. I mean, like, if you're dating someone and they don't have any friends and they don't talk to anyone in their family, think about it. Doesn't mean they're a bad person. They might have a bad family and whatever. But think about why, and then pay attention to the signs and pay attention to what they say about their family and try to imagine it from the other people's point of view with how you're starting to experience them too.
And we're going to talk a little bit about narcissistic family members and also narcissistic coworkers or people that you work with. But as far as, so we've talked about the early warning signs and kind of that love bombing period, but are there any other predictable patterns that people should be aware of, like that perhaps being in a relationship with a narcissist kind of evolves into?
Yes. So the typical cycle in a relationship with a narcissist is, you know, you start with the love bombing where they make you feel like you're the most amazing creature on the planet. And then at the first moment of conflict, it's like once they feel slighted, then the devaluation stage is when they devalue you for, you know, disagreeing with them, having an issue with them, challenging them. And the discard when, you know, if they decide to leave you through all this usually happens when they know that you're onto their bullshit. You know, usually it's just a cycle that repeats. It's the the cycle of abuse is, you know, the honeymoon phase, the love bombing. Then you go into the devaluation and, you know, there's an abusive incident. And then they go back to the honeymoon stage where they just seduce you back. If there's a discard, in my strong opinion, from what I know about narcissism, they know that you caught them and they know that they can't come back from that. And when they're left with nothing to say or explain, that's when they disappear. Because they can't, if they can't face themselves, they can't see through themselves through your eyes anymore. And there's nothing that they can say to anymore to make an excuse or to lie or bullshit you or gaslight you. All those manipulation tactics that they use, they're not working anymore. That's why the relationship is over. So in a way, it's something to be proud of.
Right. They've run out of options.
Yeah.
Or you've just been like, I caught your hand right in the cookie jar.
Yeah. And so it's done. And then they just move on to another unassuming new person that they can start that with all over again. So, yeah, that's the cycle that, you know, gets talked about. And when you're dating one, it can pretty much go that way.
Woof.
You know, sometimes the other person leaves the narcissist because they've had enough. And I mean, that's great, you know, if you don't even have to get to that point. But if the narcissist is leaving you, it's because they know that you know they're bullshit. It's like there's no more games to play.
Right.
You know?
Right. And so what advice do you have for people who find themselves married to a narcissist or maybe are in long-term relationships, or maybe they've had children with a narcissist? Like, if you've discovered this and you're already legally or biologically attached to them, like, what do you do?
I mean, that's tough. And that really depends on the person and their situation. And, you know, it's like it has to be so specific to what they're going through. I couldn't really speak to that generality because, you know, I can't tell someone what to do with marriage and kids until I hear their story. And it's like, what can they do? You know, that depends on the exact situation. Right.
So maybe seeking out some professional guidance.
Yes, that would be a good idea. Talking to a therapist who understands what narcissism is and how to deal with them. But, you know, even just learning how to protect yourself in a relational way, like the tips and tools that I talk about in the book, can be really helpful. If you think that like you have to rough it out with this person, just learning how to communicate in a way that is not escalating the situation, and protecting yourself and learning how to set boundaries in like a firm way, you know, even if it's not going to change the narcissist, right? They're not going to stop being a narcissist. But there are ways to still communicate with them or interact with them in ways that are more beneficial to you, or where you can protect yourself better than you probably are if you don't if you're finding that it's, you know, going haywire all the time. You know,
yeah. And I'm skipping ahead a couple questions since you brought this up, but can you, and of course, there's a lot of this in your book, so I encourage listeners who are listening to this and going like, I need those strategies, please pick up Carla's book. The link to it will be in show notes. But what are like one or two ways that we could protect ourselves from being manipulated, whether it's by anyone on that egomaniac narcissism spectrum, or you know, even to address gaslighting.
Yeah, you can't let them push your buttons. And so when they become abusive, or they stop making sense, or they become hysterical, you know, you have to hit pause and disengage and not participate in that, and really stand firm to what your boundary is and not get swayed by all their, you know, self-victimization and manipulation and things that they do. And so I know this is very vague, and it's, you know, easier said than done. And so that's why, you know, I explain a lot of examples in the book.
Yeah.
But, you know, you don't have to participate in their bullshit. As soon as it like goes crazy, mm-hmm. you know, you just like, okay, I'm not having this conversation with you anymore because I feel like, you know, you're not listening, or, you know, this is getting too intense. We're going to have to revisit this when yeah. we've calmed down. You don't have to have the shouting match with them. You don't have to get pulled into it. And the reason that a lot of times people do is because you get emotional when you're listening to all this madness. You're like getting accused of yeah. things that you didn't do.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, putting intentions on you, that putting words in your mouth and accusing you of awful things that aren't true. And so people like go to bat to try to defend themselves and work up a sweat trying to prove like, no, like that's not me and I'm not the crazy one. And it's like, you can't, they're not listening
right,
to you.
Right.
This is not a mutual dialogue where you're trying to reach a resolution. This is the narcissist putting you in your place, keeping you under their thumb. Making sure that they're in control, that they don't look bad, and nothing else. And so, you know, you're going in circles in a circular argument. And so there are ways to kind of like de-escalate the conversation, and things that you can say to just kind of like hold your boundary and not get swept away by the current of their intensity, you know?
Yeah, but in order to not get swept away by the current, you first have to recognize that you're in water.
Yeah.
Right? And look around and go like, oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like that parable of the fish, you know, someone's like, how's the water? And they're like, what water? They
yeah,
don't even know.
Yeah.
But that's where your section on Know Your Enemy can be helpful, right? Because you outline those specific types of manipulators and the kind of manipulation tactics that they might use. Because I also understand that like narcissism can be a lot more covert, and there is such a thing as covert narcissism. Mm-hmm. So maybe you're not getting in an argument, but maybe there's just subtle blame being put on you, or just small little critiques that are making you go like, oh, I guess I did push him away, or I guess I did do that thing to her, or something, right? So being able to fight against the pattern requires you to first
recognize what's happening to you.
Right.
Like recognize that you're being controlled, or recognizing what's happening. It's kind of like, you know, the analogy you were saying, like the frog in water, right? If you put a frog in boiling water, it's just going to like try to crawl right out, freak out and get out. It's hot, right?
Yeah.
But if you put a frog in the water and then you turn up the heat slowly, the frog's not going to realize it's in boiling hot water until it's too late, and then he can't get out.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's kind of like these relationships where, you know, it's not like a narcissist just steps in and controls you and abuses you and, you know, whips you around and you take it like an idiot.
Yeah.
They start out seducing you and charming you and loving you and making you feel great. And then the first incident, it's usually a small one. It's subtle. It's like, oh, okay, that was weird, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's more and more and more. And when you don't set boundaries, or you don't advocate for yourself in a strong, solid way, they're going to keep pushing the limits. And eventually you realize you're in this situation where you're just trying to please them and get them to treat you well again, instead of taking care of yourself.
Right. And recognizing, no, this is the true core of who they are.
Right.
Not the first 3 or 6 months.
Right.
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 So let's talk for a second about narcissism and family members.
Yeah.
So children of narcissists, you've talked about, you know, how that can maybe breed other narcissists in the family genetically. But what are some of the specific challenges faced by people who were raised by narcissistic parents?
Yeah, it can go a number of different ways because, again, it depends on the child's genetic personality and a lot of other factors, too, like birth order and the disposition of the siblings and what everyone else is doing.
Mm-hmm.
Family systems are really complicated and fascinating in that way. And so if there's a narcissistic parent, it depends on what you're like and who's around you. So if you are like the narcissistic parent, you're most likely going to be a narcissist too, potentially even worse, because now there's a narcissist raising you, positively reinforcing these behaviors. A lot of times, children who are not predisposed to narcissism become what I talk a lot about in Chapter 9, Knowing Yourself, the people pleaser, the caretaker, the empath, the codependent, right? Like, you get so used to orbiting around these personalities that you neglect yourself and then just commit to taking care of other people. And so a lot of times, and then they end up with a narcissist too. So if you're not aware of your family dynamic and you start dating, you know, you might date a narcissist like your mom or your dad who was a narcissist.
Right. And we all tend to date people that remind us of our parents in some way, right? That was our first blueprint for relationship.
Right. So that's why you want that awareness of what role, this is what I talk a lot about in that chapter, is like what role you played in your family. We all played a role. Mm-hmm. And the role that we played was meant to keep us safe. Mm-hmm. We figured out how to either like get the most attention or stay out of trouble or stay safe or whatever. And you play that role, whether, you know, you're the family, you're the golden child, the scapegoat, the clown, whatever. You play this role, and then that's what you kind of continue to do in your adult relationships. And the problem with that is that that role doesn't always work in the adult world with everyone. And if that's the only role you know, it can get you into trouble or kind of like not help your relationships.
It just sounds like such a complicated thing to start to untangle, but self-awareness is the first step.
Right. That's the first step.
And so at work, let's talk about what happens if your boss or a coworker is narcissistic. Like, how do those individuals typically function at work? In workplace settings.
Oh my God, run. No. yeah, I mean, it depends on your situation, obviously. But like the thing with having to be around narcissists is like, look, don't get too close. You know, I talk kind of right away in the beginning of the book too about just being kind of neutral, where it's like, remain neither impressed nor distressed, right? Like you're like, don't like, kind of, like, don't let them rattle you. Like,
they'll just realize they can't get something from you.
Yeah. Like, they like to manipulate people who are easy to manipulate. And so those are people who have an emotional reaction to them.
Mm. And either really positive or really negative.
Right. I mean, both, because the positive reaction, they have your buy-in. They got you. And so they might try to manipulate you. The negative reaction that are, now there's a vendetta against you, or, you know, like whatever it is, just keep a wall, like be not too accessible. You know, if it's your boss, you know, do your job, be compliant, be, you know, but try, you want to always kind of keep an arm's length with a narcissist. If they're in your, a relative in your family or someone at work, you don't want them to have too much access to you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's kind of the idea, right? Like, you want to kind of have some sort of protection around you, some wall, some sense of like they can't get their hooks into you.
Yeah.
You know, they can come talk to you. You know, you'll do your job, like whatever. Mm-hmm. Talk about your, you know, your Sunday. But they don't have full access to you.
Yeah. I love that. And for those who have been close to a narcissist, right, relationship-wise, romantically, in their families, at work, what does the healing process for a person who has gotten out of that relationship typically involve? And are there any misconceptions about recovery?
You know, it involves continuing to set boundaries and practicing that with other healthy individuals, so that like you can see that when you set a boundary, it is usually a positive, well-received step in a relationship that goes well. If it didn't go well with the narcissist, you can practice it on someone who actually wants to respect your boundary, so that you can continue to take care of yourself around other people who are also taking care of themselves, and you're taking care of each other. So it's really like about practicing those ways of taking care of yourself and advocating for yourself around people that are safe to do that with. Mm-hmm. And so it's constructing and maintaining other healthy relationships. A lot of times it's building your confidence back.
Yeah.
You lose yourself in these relationships. And so you have to kind of get back to yourself and think about who you were before this person.
Right.
And if that was a really long time ago, who do you want to be? What kind of person would you like to become? You know? What was taken from you and get that back, kind of, you know. And I have a whole chapter on building confidence. So there are like little things you can think about and do.
I know. It's so great. I actually, something that I really like about your book, in addition to that like straightforward language and, you know, the swearing and the give it to me straight way that you write, is you offer interviews with manipulative individuals, which I thought was wild, reflections for the reader, and journaling opportunities, which makes it feel active. And, you know, like, it's like, okay, maybe you're not sitting in Carla's office, but, you know, you've got your kind of strategies right there. And so my follow-up questions are like, what strategy, if you could just like name one or two, would you recommend for someone who wants to start to build or rebuild their confidence, particularly if they are just like fresh out of something that was pretty manipulative and jarring?
Of all the things that I talk about, again, it's kind of going back to client specificity, right? Like,
yeah.
Well, what aspect of low self-esteem are they suffering from, right? Like, is it social anxiety? Is it, right? Like
yeah.
What is their thing?
Right. You know? Well, riffing on that, one part of the Rebuilding Confidence chapter that I really loved, speaking of social anxiety, is you use this metaphor about approaching social situations as the buyer, not the seller.
Yeah.
And let me know if I miss anything in this, but, and I have definitely approached most social situations as the seller. So for example, if you use the example of a used car lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're the seller and a buyer walks in, you're like, look at all these amazing cars I have. Look at all their value. Look at all the great bells and whistles that come with them.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you like this? Wouldn't you like one?
Mm-hmm.
But if you're the buyer, you're looking around going like, let me get to know this car. Let me see if it's even got the features I need or like. You know, you've got that, what I hear is this healthy discernment of that, like, and that you are in the position of discerning versus, does this person like me, right? Or getting someone to like you.
Instead of pick me, it's let me see if I want this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me see if you're worthy, and not in like a snarky or, dare I say, narcissistic way, but in a way that is healthy and protective.
Yeah.
Now knowing that you can be manipulated by the people you get close to,
and
having that level of discernment.
Right. And the reason that works well for social anxiety is because social anxiety is all about a fear of being exposed. And so when they enter social situations, it's like, oh, all the eyes are on me and I'm afraid I'm going to say something stupid or look stupid. And that's what social anxiety is. And so when you approach the situation in this way, you reverse the focus is now not on yourself and how you're performing, which is what people with social anxiety focus on.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, you're focusing on how the person in front of you is performing and do you like it? And so it takes all that heat and focus off yourself, which that's what someone with social anxiety needs kind of to be doing.
Yeah. And something that I embarrassingly only started doing in the last few years is paying attention to, does the person across from me ask me questions, right? Because it used to be just like, am I interesting to them? Am I, you know, people-pleasy? And now I just kind of notice, and I don't judge, you know? I'm just like, have they asked me any follow-up questions? Have they, you know, like, are they showing genuine curiosity? And if not, even if I'm excited about that person, I let it go.
Yeah, and it kind of goes back to what we were saying from the very beginning about how to spot a narcissist. If they don't ever ask you anything, like, it doesn't mean they're a narcissist, but, you know, it's just one thing to kind of pay attention to and then see if there are other things. And so Like, you should be entering a social situation thinking about, how does this person make me feel when I'm around them? Not, am I doing a good job making them like me?
Yeah. And it's so wild when you start to tune into that and you'll be like, wait, but this person is so nice and loved and warm, but I just feel so tense when I'm around them all the time, or I just feel some kind of way.
Yeah.
Pay attention to that.
That's your intuition telling you to run.
Yeah. And sometimes it's like the disconnect between the mind and body can be such a mind-blowing experience.
Right.
And so as far as reflections that, and Carla has many of these in the book, but for the folks who are listening to this right now and wondering, oh shit, am I in a relationship with an egomaniac or a narcissist, or is my sibling or parent or uncle, you know, displaying these tendencies, like, are there any prompts that you would just offer that they could maybe reflect on after this episode ends, you know, this evening or tomorrow?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes what we just said, like, how does it feel when you're around this person? How does it feel in your body? And how do you feel? Do they make you feel good? Or do you feel invisible or tense or uncomfortable?
Or walking on eggshells.
Right, and right. Like, and that experience when a narcissist creates that feeling of everybody orbiting around them, like they force everyone to orbit around them if you're participating. And so when you're feeling like you have to kind of meet their needs and ignore and neglect yourself, those are cues to pay attention to. You know, it's that feeling more than anything. Like, really try to check in with yourself about how you're feeling around this person. Mm-hmm. If it feels like it's all about them, it probably is. Run.
Wow. So, Carla, do you have any last words for, you know, anything that you want to leave listeners with when it comes to the topic of narcissism or healing?
Yeah. You know, something I talk with my clients about a lot is boundaries, and they're learning for the first time that, like, setting boundaries doesn't make you mean or strict. It's actually like a way to help people have a good relationship with you. It gives people an opportunity to have an even better relationship with you because you're telling them about yourself, what you need and what your limits are. And you get to find out about them too, because you can find out if they're caring enough to try to meet those needs or not, or if they can't. And then you need to know that, right? A narcissist doesn't even want to hear about your boundary.
Yeah.
And so then you know, like, okay, they're a narcissist, right? Or maybe they're not a narcissist, but they can't meet your needs. You need to know that and then take care of yourself, because you're more important than a fantasy relationship that will never materialize because they're not who you thought they were. They can't give you what you want.
Yeah. Including friendships, romantic relationships.
Yeah.
All of those things.
Anyone. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'll just speak for myself here. I wasn't taught to set healthy boundaries when I was growing up.
Yeah.
It's a skill that I've had to learn as an adult and remain in study to try and master.
Yeah.
And it can feel terrifying to set a boundary, but the right people will say, oh my gosh, thank you for telling me.
Absolutely.
And the wrong people will absolutely lose their shit.
Yeah.
And then you can grieve. And, you know, grieve and try and heal and make space for more of the right people. Like you were saying, building your network.
Right.
You know, in that last section of your book. And I think the one other that one other big lesson, in case it's helpful for anyone listening, is when I've come across professional boundary crossers who feel like they may make a living doing that, for a while, I thought I was bad at setting or upholding boundaries. And I realized that that's not always the case, that some people are just really good at pushing or crossing them.
Yeah.
And that's when you can remove yourself from the situation, right? Remove access to yourself.
I mean, you shouldn't have to explain it over and over. If you feel like you need to, like, understand it for them, it's like, that's too much.
It's too much.
Like, say it once or twice. If they don't get it, I mean, that's their problem. Like, however someone reacts or responds to your boundary is their problem. That's their mm-hmm. process. Like, you don't need to make it, to cushion it for them or make it nice for them or do whatever, you know, take your boundary back. Absolutely don't do that. Because that's what they're trying to do sometimes, you know, manipulate mm-hmm. you to collapse your boundary. So just remember that if you've thought about it and you set your boundary, whatever happens after that, that's their process. That's not for you to worry about.
Such wise words. Easier said than done, but so powerful. True. If you can embody that.
True.
You know, so once again, Carla's book is Outsmarting Egomaniacs, How to Respond to Narcissists and Master Manipulators. The link to buy the book is in show notes. And for those of you who would like to learn more about Carla or get in touch with her, her website and her links are also in show notes in the description of this episode. So, Carla, thank you so, so very much for coming on and for all of your insights and wisdom and for the fresh and witty perspective, and just so grateful to have explored this topic with you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. It was a pleasure.
And with that,
life is abundant.
Go Help Yourself was produced in Los Angeles, California by Misty Stinnett and Lisa Linke. The fabulous music you're hearing right now and the theme song were composed by Sav. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can reach us at gohelpyourselfpodcast@gmail.com or on our website, gohelpyourself.co. We also have a top secret episode on there that you can't get anywhere else. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.